WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
James Warhol's book about his uncle Andy Warhol is set in 1962. 3 years later, the Velvet Underground started recording. In its early days, the band was managed by Andy Warhol. The Velvet Underground never made the charts, but today they're recognized as one of the most important bands in rock history. After the release of a box set collecting the Velvet's recordings from 1965 to 70, our rock historian Ed Ward looked back on the Velvet's first recordings.
$6 in my hand. Up to Lexington, 125. Feel sick and dirty, more dead than alive. I'm waiting for the man.
Things didn't look good for American rock and roll in 1965. The Brits were running riot over our charts, and while Retaliation was in the works, it seemed like it would be a long time before we came up with anything half as innovative or important as the Beatles or the Rolling Stones were doing. Actually, though, something did happen, something that was ignored at the time, the Velvet Underground. The Velvet Underground was the result of a unique group of talents getting together. Lewis Allen Reed, a troubled Long Island teenager who'd recorded while still in high school and then attended Syracuse University to study literature, Sterling Morrison, who was attending classes there, but never registered, and John Cale, who met Reed while they were both working at a schlock rock label, recording Hot Rod novelty records in the year after Reed's graduation. Reed and Morrison had the literary background, Cale the avant-garde musical chops. He'd come from his native Wales on a Leonard Bernstein scholarship and was performing with Lamont Young, father of today's avant-garde, and hacking out rock novelties to pay the bills. The three started jamming at Cale's downtown New York loft, and the results sounded like Simon and Garfunkel, until the lyrics kicked in.
Shiny, shiny boots of leather, whiplash girl child in the dark, comes in bells your servant, don't forsake him. Strike, dear mistress, cure his heart.
They added Maureen Tucker, sister of Morrison's college roommate, on drums after their first drummer proved too weird and started calling themselves the Velvet Underground after a book on suburban sadomasochism they'd found in the street. Journalist Al Aronowitz got them a steady gig at Café Bazaar. They were fired before too long, but not before attracting the attention of Andy Warhol, who needed a band for a multimedia spectacular he was planning, and early in 1966, he produced their first album. Those songs from Cale's loft were transformed.
Shiny, shiny, shiny boots of leather, whiplash girl child in the dark, comes in bells, your servant don't forsake him. Strike, dear mistress, and cure his heart.
Cale's electric viola, the droning guitars, not to mention the subject matter, this was something new. But Warhol insisted that the four weren't glamorous enough, and he added a singer, Christa Päfgen, a German model who'd been doing some recording in London and used the name Nico. She added another dimension to the sound. Vocal range was identical to Reed's, and yes, she was glamorous, in a chilly sort of way. Having Warhol's art cachet freed the band to experiment sonically, too, and here Cale's genius kicked in. the notorious noise blowout, starting with an electrified metal chair being scraped across the floor in European Sun, was definitely aimed at the New York art crowd. They'd released their first album while they were still riding high on their success in Warhol's Plastic Exploding Inevitable show, they might have achieved some notoriety, but things dragged on and it didn't appear until early 1967, at which point Peace and Love didn't want to know about those boots of shiny, shiny leather. Undaunted, the band went back into the studio in September to make a second record, without Nico, and with their avant-garde tendencies in full cry. White Light, White Heat was a truly inspired failure. Some of it was virtually unlistenable more than once, like Cale's reading an undergraduate short story of Reed's on The Gift. And then there was Sister Ray, 17 minutes of ghastly noise that sort of grew on you if you could stay the course. Distorted almost to the point of pain, with perverse lyrics, this music opposed nearly everything the new era seemed to stand for. The album vanished almost without a trace. Warhol was out of the picture, and tension between Cale and Reed was reaching a high point. Who would have thought they stood on the verge of making one of the greatest albums of all time?
Rock historian Ed Ward lives in Berlin. The great album he just referred to is called The Velvet Underground.